Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's talk. This, as you probably know, is part of a series of public events that the LSE's Hellenic Observatory organizes. And we've been very pleased over the years to welcome a number of prominent speakers from Greece. We also have a varied events program. We have research seminars with visiting academics. You can find more information about the Hellenic Observatory on the LSE's website about our events, and we hope to see you at some of those future seminars or lectures. We're delighted to welcome our speaker tonight, George Papakonstantinou. George knows the LSE very well. He obtained both his undergraduates and his PhD in economics from the school. And in fact, he met his wife, Jacqueline, here, both studying economics at the LSE. In actual fact, George knows this particular theatre extremely well. When George was a student here in the 1980s, believe it or not, he not only acted in various theatre productions on this very stage, but he also was the producer of an LSE student production of the Threepenny Opera, I believe. The Threepenny Opera, Bertolt Brecht's socialist critique of capitalism with the music of Mac the Knife. One can only wonder whether years later, when meeting the German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble, did he whistle and sing Mac the Knife to Mr. Schäuble? One can only imagine the effects of that. Latterly, George has spoken at the LSE more recently in 2010, when, of course, at that stage, he was Minister of Economics in the PASOK government of George Papandreou. As such, of course, at the time, he was truly in the eye of the storm, dealing with the Troika, with the Eurozone partners, with the financial markets. George was the lead for the government in the early strategy of the bailout. Alongside that, not only was he dealing with the Eurozone partners and the financial markets, and not only was I and many other people learning for the first time in my life about things such as naked credit default swaps, or whatever they are, not only was he dealing with fanciful instruments on the financial markets, he was also, of course, dealing with domestic political pressures. George has now written his memoirs of these turbulent years. As you can see here, the book cover, Game Over, the inside story of the Greek crisis. I've read the book, and I have benefited very much from the account. I think it's a very objective, very open account of the various issues that have arisen and his response to the criticisms that have been raised during this period. And let me say, I think George's decency shines through the account that he has given. We've arranged for George to speak for 25, 30 minutes or whatever, and that should allow us plenty of time for questions and answers afterwards, plenty of time for your contributions later. But I'm delighted to welcome back someone I'm privileged to regard as a personal friend and a friend of the LSE. Can you join me in welcoming our speaker this evening, George Papakonstantinou?
Thank you very much to Kevin, to the Hellenic Observatory, and to all of you for being here. I guess Kevin revealed my past in this room and in this stage. I have to confess, it looked much bigger. Somehow, it seemed to have shrunk with the years, or maybe But yes, the last time I was standing here was at the end of a production of the Threepenny Opera, which Kevin described, I think, accurately. I had no idea what I would be doing later in my life. And the last time I spoke at the school was in 2010, and then I had no idea I would be back 7 years later, discussing pretty much the same kind of issues in a situation which is still unresolved. So I tried, after the end of my short ministerial tenure, after some time passed, to put everything down in a book. And I will be talking, using the book as a background, to talk a little bit about this whole period and to discuss what happened and where we're going from here. And many of you here have followed this from very close. I see a number of friends and people who know about the Greek situation. I even see some people that were with me in that production of the Threepenny Opera, which is even nicer. So, you know, people who regard themselves as authors, and this is how I describe myself nowadays, first of all, write a book for themselves. You write a book first and foremost because you feel a need to actually put down on paper or on the keyboard what you are feeling, what you're thinking, what you've gone through. And so it is very much a personal testimonial. It is, I think, a cautionary tale in politics from somebody who had one of the fastest and shortest rise and fall sequences in politics. I was an outsider, was first elected to parliament in 2007. The post of the finance minister was my first ministerial post. It was the mother of all battles. At the time, people were telling me I had the most difficult job in Europe, but they told this to many people after me as well, so that's okay. And at the end of this period came a crash. And at the end of the crash came even a period where I was hauled in front of a court and almost ended up in jail. So it is a cautionary tale in politics. And those of you that have read or will read the book will read about also the personal story behind the events of the country and the broader European events. But of course, it is mostly a narrative about Greece, about why we got here, what we did, and how we're coping now. It lays no claim in providing a theoretical framework about the crisis, but I think that anyone who reads this with an open mind will get a pretty clear sense of the reasons why Greece ended up where it did, the kind of options that were available, the kind of beliefs that people had and turned out to be completely false in terms of alternatives that were not really there, and some of the reasons why we're still not out of the woods. It is also, I would like to think, a way of understanding how Europe works, not about how Europe should work, not about how Europe is supposed to be designed to work, but how Europe actually managed or tried to manage or mismanage a crisis that should have been foreseen, but was not. So going through various Eurogroup meetings and other meetings that either by myself or with then Prime Minister George Papandreou, or afterwards where I was observing my successors participate, I think you get a pretty good sense of the people, because a lot of it is about people and about their chemistry and their interaction, about the institutions and how they have evolved, and they have evolved tremendously since 2010, about the decisions that were made, the good ones and the bad ones, and there were plenty from both type. A word about the title of the book. Many people have asked me, well, you know, isn't this, what do you mean game over? Isn't this not terribly pessimistic? Is it game over for the country? Of course not. And this is obviously not what the title means. But it is certainly game over for a way of doing things in Greece. It is game over for the kind of state that doesn't know how much it's spending and where or how it should be collecting taxes. It is game over for an economy that basically borrows to then pay for imports. That's game over. But we still haven't quite, and that I think is the problem at the moment, replaced this with a fresh narrative that is compelling enough to allow Greece to exit the crisis. So I'm going to try and do three things. One is to say a little bit about where we are, then the lessons to be learned, and then look a little bit forward. So let me start with the, you know, where are we? Three bailouts later, 110 billion in 2010, 130 in 2012, another 86 in 2015. Not additive, it doesn't add up to all of this, but it is certainly more than 1.5 times the Greek GDP, and it is the biggest loan that, or collection of loans ever given to a country. One mega debt haircut later, the first time you had a sovereign debt haircut within the Eurozone, 100 billion in nominal debt shaved off in gross terms. In net terms, it's half that, because then you have to take into account the money that was used to recapitalize the banks and other things. But it's a big number. And people often forget what we're talking about, the necessary additional debt relief, that you've already had a massive debt relief in 2012, 2013. And of course, this is a crisis that has consumed four prime ministers, nine finance ministers. I was the first of the series. And it is telling to simply observe that I took up my function as Greek finance minister about a week before Wolfgang Schäuble took up his function as German finance minister. So he has seen many faces come in front of him. And every time he sees a freshman, he goes, oh, yeah. So this simply goes to show that you've had a complete implosion of the Greek political system, and we still haven't quite navigated that to the end. Four elections and one referendum later, the well-known referendum in mid-2015 that almost cost Greece its position within the Eurozone. And of course, a crisis which is multifaceted. It's not simply economic. It is a societal crisis. It's a political crisis, apart from being an economic and financial crisis. And you could think of it in two phases, the first being between 2009 and 2014, and then the second phase, which is the last 2 years, 2015 and 2016. This is my only page with graphs, but I think they're quite telling. Real GDP today, if I took a starting point, which is 2000, which is when Greece entered the Eurozone, and if you plot the euro area GDP over time, you can see, in the blue line, you can see the impact of the recession in 2008, 2009, and then it picks up again. With Greece, you have a perfect bell curve, not the right kind of statistics bell curve, one that says that you are now back to being below where you were before you entered the euro, with a huge boom between 2008, and then decline after that, and with a second dip after 2015, with sort of being stagnant since then. To the right, you see our debt problem. The difference between the Greek and euro area debt has always been there, and we've hovered around 100%, thinking for a very long time that this was comfortable. At least it wasn't going 100%, but it was a knife edge, and clearly debt to GDP, when you're not really controlling your numerator, the minute the denominator collapses, then you see what happens in 2008, and it goes all the way up to 130%. The dip is the impact of the haircut, and then it goes up again, and where it will go is a hot topic of discussion at the moment with the various debt sustainability analysis of the institutions. And, of course, the social, the economic and social aspect, which I think is seen very clearly in the two bottom graphs, where if you look at unemployment as a whole, we're pretty much at the same level as the euro area average until 2009, and then it explodes. And the fact that it has kind of ebbed a little bit since 2014 is great, but I don't think it's much consolation to the 23% that remain unemployed. And on the right, a structural problem that we've always had in Greece, which is that youth unemployment is significantly above and now has exploded to being over 50%, even though I hasten to add for the economists in this area, in this room, we all know that youth unemployment is not properly recorded, but it's still very, very high, even if it's not 50%. Is it all bad news? Well, no, it is not. There's some good news. And the good news is, first of all, the fiscal side. You've had in Greece an absolutely massive fiscal correction, the type of fiscal correction we haven't seen anywhere else. Going from a fiscal deficit above 15%, almost 16%, to being close to 2%. It is very hard to find other historical examples of such a correction in such a short time. And or if you take out the expenditure for interest, from a primary deficit of over 10% to a surplus. And we're now at the point where we're debating how long can you sustain and at what level should the surplus be sustained to be able to control the debt. But it is a massive feat, and it is, of course, a feat on the back of sacrifices of many people, because on the expenditure side, it has slashed the public sector wage bill. It is as a result of cuts in pensions, and on the revenue side, it is the result of massive increases in tax rates. I was the first, many followed the kind of tax hikes that we did. There's also some good news on the external account, because we were in a position where, as a member of a common currency area, we had a huge external competitiveness deficit, which has been all but wiped out. But a word of caution here, this has come much more from the collapse of imports that has come from a rebounding export sector, which continues to be a big problem for Greece. The outward-oriented sector of the economy hasn't really been picked up, and you can see this in the growth figures. And a host of extensive but still incomplete structural reforms in pensions, the tax system, the budget, in protecting the labor markets, in privatizations. And here I'd like to say that many people actually underestimate the extent of structural reforms. And my thesis is that once the economy starts picking up, all the work that has been done, again, incomplete, with problems, with holes, without having touched certain things that should have been touched, should show up in a high growth potential and high productivity for the country. Next to the economy, of course, is politics and society, an implosion of the old political system, the rise of populism. We were the first country in Europe to elect a populist party into government, which then decided to govern in a coalition with an extreme right populist party, so a rather bizarre arrangement where the common thread was the opposition to the bailouts, and a complete hollowing out of the political center, which is, of course, not unique to Greece. The difficulty of the center-left in Europe to sort of find its place in difficult economic times and to have a convincing narrative which is not as convincing as the narrative of cutting everything, which is what we tend to do, but isn't really convincing enough to keep people who want a more genuine alternative solution to their problems. And a society that has gone, you know, I often compare this to the five stages of grief, you know, denial, anger, and then eventually, after you settle, some kind of resignation. But, you know, behind the mood change is our real issues of increased poverty, increased inequality. I think whatever efforts were made with different degrees of success to shield some of the most vulnerable people in a massive correction of this type, a massive fiscal consolidation, everyone gets hurt, and the most vulnerable get hurt most. At the same time, the cuts have led to deterioration of public services. As an economist, one may look at the reduced expenditures for health or education and say, well, we have rationalized the system, but as a user of those services, it's clear that you're not getting what you should be out of your taxes. And an increased cynicism, because now that the last sort of hopes were dashed with the last 2 years of Syriza, many people are saying, well, they also lied to us. So they're all the same. There is no solution, which is a terrible thing for a society to not be able to look forward with some confidence. And the underlying question to all of this, out of all this period, is there self-awareness of what got us into it in the first place? Or is there still some denial? And here I have to say that, unfortunately, there's still a lot of denial. If you pose a simple question in Greece and you put two options. Option A, the situation in 2009. In 2009, the outgoing government concealed the true extent of the fiscal problems. Or B, the incoming government in 2009 inflated the deficit in order to bring in the IMF and sell out the country. I'm afraid that B is going to win. And you can see this in the prosecution, for example, of the statistics chief, Andreas Georgiou, who cleaned up the data, and finally we got a passing mark from Eurostat on their quality, and they have not been, there's been no problem with them since, and that guy is actually continues to be facing courts, and unfortunately a big part of the political system plays the game of blaming him and not the real situation. It was the fault of the data and not the fault that we got where we did get. Now, let me try and broaden a little bit the lens before I go to the lessons. I think we can all agree that in 2009, Europe was caught a little bit like a deer in the headlights. It was an accident waiting to happen, except we thought it would never happen. And the initial response was, well, it's a Greek problem. All they need to do is show that they can reduce the deficit, the markets would react. No, the markets were looking for something else. The markets were looking for a stopgap. They were looking for a guarantee of no default. This was not forthcoming. Eventually it did, and it did in May 2010 when the first bailout was agreed. And then slowly you shifted from the response of the firefighter to try to repair the institutional infrastructure. And that's a very long journey because it involves changing the institutions. What is the role of the ECB in all of this? And we've seen how the ECB has evolved. It involves the Commission learning how to operate in this new environment. And more importantly, it involves circumventing rules such as the no bailout rule, which was enshrined in the treaty, and coming up with initially ad hoc mechanisms and eventually mechanisms for support of countries in trouble, such as the European Stability Mechanism. It's been a long period. And it's got many different aspects. The banking union is a big, very important aspect where we to try and break the feedback, the negative feedback loop between sovereigns and banks, where banks were loaded with sovereign debt and then taxpayers would pick up that and they would go around and around. We've tried to create this new toolbox, and the institutions have evolved, but still we're in the early stages. It's still a German game. Nothing gets decided and then Berlin says yes or no. And this is something that somehow has to be faced as we move forward after we go through all the elections in 2017. We have for lack of a better word, an ordo-liberal approach to the extent of austerity which is necessary in all countries. I have never believed that austerity is a means in itself. It is... is a goal in itself. It is often a means, but when you think of it as a goal in and of itself, then you end up in situations which are not conducive to growth and welfare. You have very little real economic policy debate and very little convergence. No real further integration. In fact, the opposite. You have the North and the South sort of going apart. And a clear shift away from the community approach towards intergovernmentalism. It always struck me how in before critical summits in 2010-2011, the German chancellor would go in front of the Bundestag, announce what she was going to go for in the summit, arriving in the summit, state her position to the waiting journalists, And that was it. We all knew what Germany was going to do, and we all knew what the result of give or take, you know, because she always left a little bit of leeway for negotiations, we all knew where it was going to go. So, or Germany agreeing with France beforehand, discussing and then telling France how to behave. So you've moved from a very different conception of what Europe is supposed to be to pure intergovernmentalism. So let's now move to the lessons. And here we could take, of course, ages because things went wrong on so many levels. Clearly at the domestic level in Greece, clearly at the EU level, at international institutions such as the IMF that got it wrong. In the markets, you know, we often forget that until mid-2008, early 2009, markets were content to lend to Greece at an interest rate which was only 0.3 higher than what they were lending to Germany. And if you think back on that, it is a completely different universe. And nobody thought that this is strange, that Greece can somehow have the same kind of risk profile as Germany or France or the Netherlands or Finland. So I try to package the lessons going from the very simple and generic to the more substantial and complicated. A very first simple one is that things tend to catch up with you. If you're a country which has broken or at least incomplete institutions, and if you're running with fiscal laxity for a very long time, eventually the whole thing will crash down. Similarly, if you have created a common currency which you know from the very beginning that it cannot really work simply on a monetary base but no fiscal policy to support it and no transfers, well, you're going to come up with a problem because it cannot withstand an asymmetric shock. And then even if you do things right, you end up in trouble. In the beginning of the crisis, people were telling us, you need to take more measures. You need to do more austerity. We did. And then they would turn around and say, oh, but with all the measures you've taken, growth will suffer. You will have social protests, so you're not going to be able to make it. So you couldn't win. And this was part of the narrative that continued throughout the crisis. Time is expensive. Successive Greek governments haven't quite yet figured this out. A deal today is better than a deal tomorrow. Because tomorrow you end up signing pretty much the same things you would have signed in the very beginning in a much worse situation. We can see this now. We saw it very clearly in 2015. Also, negotiation is a delicate game. It is not a game of chicken. And it is certainly not a game of chicken when you are driving a moped and from the other side comes a big German truck. The German truck will win. You have to find a different way to negotiate that understands the rule and is sensitive to the geopolitical issues that are in the European family. And finally, ad hoc solutions are second best. We came up with a Greek loan facility in the beginning, and then slowly we started building the institutions that were necessary. It took a very long time to actually arrive at some kind of stability in terms of what the tools were appropriate. Then there's a host of lessons on program design. The one that everybody asks, of course, is what is the right degree of austerity? Here it's important to remember that the Greek programs were not the result of some kind of an optimal economic design. They were thought backwards. How much money is there on the table? How much money are the creditors willing to put down? And that determined the fiscal path. So I'm perfectly happy to agree with people who say, well, you did too much austerity or too early or you compressed it. But that was the money that was available on the table. If we had double the money, then we would have gotten more time and you could have spread out. And the fact that we ended up with three consecutive bailouts rather than coming up with one which was big enough to be able to buy us more time was clearly a design fault. But this is because the programs were always this delicate balance between sound economics and feasible politics. And feasible politics, meaning what can I get through my parliament, tended to have the upper hand. What's the right policy mix? That's a classic for people in any kind of adjustment programs. People often in Greece think that the programs were overly skewed towards the revenues. That's true of the third program. It is not true of the second, and it's certainly not true of the first, which was actually much more skewed towards expenditure cutting rather than revenue increases. Sequencing reforms. It is very clear that when you are doing a massive fiscal consolidation, it is not easy, both in terms of capacity to implement or in terms of generating the political capital, to also open up all fronts on the structural reform area. And also there are very difficult decisions to make between sequencing, for example, do you put product or labor market reform firms? And I think there we got it wrong, because as a result of putting labor market reform first, you've had a complete collapse of wages. Prices have not followed. And that has unintended consequence for the economy. Then there are the issues of implementation capacity. It took institutions, the Troika, otherwise the institutions otherwise known as Troika, a very long time to realize the lack of implementation capacity for a country like Greece. I have often said, and I know it is not politically correct to say so, that Greece was more a World Bank case than an IMF case. It needed serious support for institutional reform. Not just the task force that came to help us, not just the very good technical assistance from the IMF on the budget side and the tax side. Much more long-term, deep institutional reform to be able to implement all this. It was not just, there was also lack of political will, often, but it was not only that. It was a question of the lack of the people and the knowledge to be able to put into place an extremely complicated long-term program. And finally, of course, the big elephant in the room, the debt restructuring question. I leave that. I'll come back to it because I think it's one that will finally, there's some political economy lessons. You know, the famous phrase that Jean-Claude Juncker is fond of saying, you know, we all know what to do. We just don't know how to do it and then get reelected. Good policies is not necessarily good politics. Good politics means, as we've seen in the last year and a half, pretending or shouting that you do not want to do what you're doing and that you're being dragged to do it. Good policy is to actually own the program, but good politics in terms of being rewarded for it is actually the exact opposite. It is to denounce the program and the creditors and pretend that you're only doing this because you're forced to do it. But this is terrible for the real effort of reforming the country. Now, let me come to some of the questions that I think many people have when they look at the Greek crisis. One of my favorite ones is, was it all just a bailout of French and German banks? Well, yes, it was also a bailout of French and German banks in the context of of keeping the integrity of the Eurozone. But those that think it was simply a bailout of French and German banks, I think, have a very reductionist view of what the crisis was about. Could the bailout have been avoided? Another favorite one in Greece. Well, it depends how far back you want to go. If you think that the bailout could have been magically avoided the 2 months before it happened, the first one, you're wrong. If you think that a couple of years before, if you had done the right things, then you could have avoided bailout, yes, that's more like it. Should Greece have been allowed to default in 2010? Many people believe that this would have been a solution. I violently disagree. I think we took the least bad of the various available options. But the one that is a really that touches me and that bothers me as a Greek is the very legitimate question: why is Greece still the only country in a bailout? You know, Portugal after us, out. Ireland after us, out. Cyprus, a very dramatic bailout, out. What is it? Is it in the water? Is it the DNA? I think there's a number of explanations which range from the worst initial conditions. We were an outlier in all metrics, I think. The lack of political consensus, unlike Portugal, unlike Ireland, we managed throughout this period to not agree on the basics. We had the country's conservative party denouncing everything that a socialist party was trying to do to get the deficit under control, only to flip once it was in power, and then reluctantly implement what it was denouncing before. And, of course, the leftist opposition, which pretended that you can, you know, sing the tune and the markets will dance to it, etc. And of course, all the talk about Grexit, which was tremendously harmful to the program, and significant specific decisions which were detrimental. And I single out here the Deauville decision in October 2010, where walking on the beachfront of the picturesque town of Deauville in Normandy, Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy took a momentous decision, which in principle was right. The decision, the base of the decision was, well, we can't have all the taxpayers footing the bill. The banks also need to pay. Therefore, if we give any more money to any country, we have to got to make sure that the debt is sustainable. And if it's not, there's got to be some restructuring up front. Correct. The problem is that we were 2010. They pre-announced that this was going to happen in 2013. So the first thing that investors did was to dump their bonds, because if you're given a promise that 3 years from now you'd lose your money, well, if you've got half a brain, you sell. And that's what triggered the Irish going under and asking for a bailout, and Portugal following that. And that what stopped a reasonably good implementation of the first program, where between the time was signed in May 2010 and November, spreads had fallen by almost 400 basis points. And people thought that, yes, maybe it's a tight path, but perhaps you can exit the markets in 2012, and the recession is not going to be that deep. So next to those questions, there's also many what-if questions. What if Greece had defaulted or threatened to default in 2010? This is the guy who has a bomb on himself and threatens to detonate it. Well, yes, there could be collateral damage. You're long dead, though, if you detonate the bomb. And the threat of detonating the bomb itself does not work. And we've seen this in 2015 in a very, very real way. One of my favorite questions, what if Ireland was the first to fall? What if Greece had managed to stick it out a little bit more and Ireland was the first one to go under a bailout? Remember, Ireland had a very different type of crisis. It was a banking crisis. It was not a tale of fiscal profligacy. If Ireland had gone down first, maybe the whole episode, the whole Eurozone crisis, would have a different kind of hue. The fact that Greece went down first allowed many to paint it in particular colors. What if debt restructuring was part of the 2010 bailout? The IMF itself has come out with ex post evaluation. Some people would call it Monday morning quarterback, of course, saying, well, you know, we should have done debt restructuring earlier on. There is no way you could have done debt restructuring in 2010. Not when the ECB was apoplectic about it and was threatening to pull the plug, and not when there wasn't a single country in Europe willing to go ahead with it, because simply the way they saw it is, you guys have 16% deficit, you lied about your statistics, and you want debt relief? Well, why don't we see you first, try and do something about your deficit, and then we can talk about that. So what if Greece had exited the Eurozone in 2015? Would it have been better off? No, is my personal answer. Perhaps some people will disagree. What if Greece had never adopted the euro? That's a tougher one. Because it's one thing to argue that the cost of exit is huge. It's a harder question to answer. I would still argue that adopting the euro was the right thing to do, but I am very sensitive to the criticism that says we went in unprepared and we didn't do the right things once we went in. These are correct criticisms. However, I have no guarantee that a country with a fiscal history of Greece, which has absolutely no experience or willingness to use the degrees of freedom that a currency gives you properly to design a real economic policy, would have fared better outside the euro than it fared within the euro. So, looking, and that's my last kind of part, looking a little bit forward. After I wrote the book, many people said, 2009, 2010, it's 6 years ago, can we just look forward? I said, of course we need to look forward, but, you know, if we don't agree amongst ourselves what happened, we're taking all the wrong lessons out of this crisis. If we still think that some dark forces conspired against us and came to, you know, to steal our national heritage, which is unfortunately an attitude that prevails, then you're not going to be able to move forward. So you do need to understand what happened in the past, and we need to disagree about it and find a common ground. But as you move forward, we are yet again in another review that is not closing, and there are a number of issues. More debt relief, not just if, but more when and how much. Pretty much everyone agrees that Greek debt is not sustainable. Now, I am one of those who believe that sustainability in many ways is in the eyes of the beholder. Japan has a debt-to-GDP ratio higher than Greece, but nobody doubts sustainability. I'm not arguing that our debt is sustainable, but I am arguing that you need to be careful about how you deal with that, and that debt relief cannot be the holy grail. It is not the answer to all the problems. You can get rid of all your debt. If you haven't fixed your institutions, you haven't done the structural reforms, end up exactly where you started. Lower primary surpluses to get the economy to breathe again. That's something that's a big discussion between the IMF, that believes in low primary surpluses, 1.5, and I think they're right, and the Eurogroup and the Commission that say 3.5. It's not that 3.5 is not feasible, it is, but it's not sound economics. You need to give the economy the breathing space to get out of its 7-year slump, and you won't if you insist on such high primary surpluses. Continued structural reforms. The big issue, together with institution building, which go beyond labor, product, financial market reform. Institution building, which extends from the judiciary to public administration, to transparency, to civil participation, you name it. We have extremely weak institutions and therefore a very low level of trust between the state and citizens. And this is something we need to be working on. And we don't need any kind of troika and any kind of memorandum to work on that. This is our own issue that we should be dealing with. Many people ask me, you know, this is all very nice, but is there space for a country like Greece? Is there space for a small country with many rigidities in a hard currency area? Does it have a future? Is there a growth path for it? I think there is, yes. And I think there's enough research that has been done to suggest that a radical liberalization of the economy, which welcomes foreign investments, because over the next 5 years we're going to need the kind of investment that domestic resources simply cannot provide, together with specific sectors, not just the ones that we always tend to talk about, such as tourism and shipping and the like, but also a lot of other sectors which are actually doing quite well in the crisis, and where you have jewels hidden in the general mess. These can drive the country forward. Is there a prospect of a fourth bailout? Yes, in the sense that there will be a follow-up arrangement. Even in my view, even in the best-case scenario where the review closes and Greece gets included into the ECB's QE, and Greece manages to issue some debt to the private markets at the second half of 2017. I doubt very much that by mid-2018 we will be able to stand completely on our feet. I think we're headed for a repeat of the discussion we had at the end of 2014 with some kind of an instrument and some kind of follow-up. And I think that that's also what our creditors want, because they're realizing that they're for the long haul and they want to keep some leverage on the country, not in the sense of, you know, buying it out, but in the sense of wanting to follow reforms through. So the question is what kind of follow-up arrangement this will be. And finally, with the question mark, the end of populism. Remember, Greece was a pioneer in that we elected the first populist party into power. We may also be pioneering in closing that circle and moving on. This should not be seen as a return to politics as usual, because politics as usual failed Greece in the past. So to actually go over the populist experiment and go back to the way things used to be done is we won't have learned anything. Finally, and this is my final finally, a few very quick words about Europe. It's clear that the, you know, why is there this renewed kind of fretting about Greece? We've seen that we see in the papers. Why is it, why are we back at the front page of the FT? It's not just because the review is not closing. It's because we are in a brand new world. And because everybody is, because we've seen the unthinkable happen in the UK, in the US, and we hope that we won't see the unthinkable happen in a number of countries in Europe. But this has gotten everyone to think, well, you know, does that make Greece much more vulnerable in the, in this environment? Well, we need, I'm of the view that 2017 is going to be better than our expectations. That we're not going to, everybody having seen 2016 believe that 2017 is going to be the end. No, I think this 2017 can be the beginning. Barring unforeseen disasters, and it's true that we have had many disasters, we can at the end of 2017 start finishing the kind of agenda that we put together a couple of years ago and which is still ongoing, about the role of macro policy, issues of symmetry and asymmetry with countries with deficit and surpluses, the role of institutions such as the ECB, because you can't simply hope that you continue getting a particular type of head of the ECB, which was a game changer. We can start talking about real EU growth policies, because we talk a lot, but we don't do very much. And more fundamentally, we start addressing some of the real issues that, that European citizens have, because the kind of political environment we are in doesn't come from a vacuum. People didn't go crazy suddenly. There is a real grievance underneath, and if we don't address it, then we will see the unthinkable happen. So thank you very much.
Thank you, George, very much indeed. We have plenty of time for questions. In fact, we've got so much time for questions, I'm going to ask the first couple of questions, if I may. Both in your presentation now, but also in the book, one of the themes that reoccurs is whether Greece can actually reform itself without an external constraint, without an external leverage, as it were. I noted in the book you talk about a large, inefficient state and a corporate private sector that feeds off it. We've got to get to the heart of the problem. Sorry, we have yet to get to the heart of the problem, despite the three bailouts. Despite the three bailouts, reform has, quote, been skin deep because of the too many vested interests. So the other connotation of game over is whether actually systemically things have changed so much, whether the system can deliver the meaningful reform that you're arguing for, or whether actually it has to be done with some kind of European intervention.
This is the irony that indeed, unfortunately, and it pains me to say so, reforms in Greece have advanced only when they have been externally imposed. At the same time, when they are externally imposed, they're not owned. Therefore, you have trouble in convincing people of their need. Mm. But let me give you just one example. Opening up of closed professions. If you bother to go back and read the pre-election manifestos of the two major parties, you will see the pledge to open closed professions come up election after election after election over the last 20 years. It was there. Did any of the parties that won dare do it? No. When did we do it? Well, we started doing it in 2010 under duress. So it does not make me particularly proud to say this, but it is true that it has proven very difficult for real reforms to be domestically started. Is this changing? I hope so, but I'm not convinced yet.
So in that sense, it would be logical for governments in the context of bailouts to perhaps use the opportunity of the leverage of the bailout to get things done which they couldn't previously dare speak of, etc. And do you think future bailouts could penetrate more deeply in terms of structural reform, or are we going to have a continuation of a kind of macroeconomic adjustment, but leaving the structural reforms that are necessary undone?
Well, if you look at the initial bailout and you look at its successors, and even if you look at the reviews after 3 months where the yes. text changed, you will see that where in the beginning structural reforms were very sort of briefly discussed,
yes.
In as you move on, where you used to have one phrase, open, close professions, it becomes three pages because you tried and you didn't manage, so the institutions come back together with the government. I have to confess that often I would put things in to make sure that they would happen. In the health sector, the same thing. In the pension system, the same thing. So yes, this has been a way of getting things done, but and also in broadening. For example, judicial reform. It's a huge issue in Greece. Mm. It has nothing to do directly with the bailout, and yet. We were forced, we took a leaf out of Portugal's bailout. I read the Portuguese bailout and I thought suddenly that they had in their milestones for delivery of decisions by courts. Not forcing courts to go faster, but at least monitoring the time needed to adjudicate tax cases. Mm. And we put this in ours. This is huge uproar. I mean, this, you know, you are trying to influence the justice system. No, but if we cannot ourselves, you know, figure out how long it takes for a tax case, which is 10, 15 years, until you get to the end of it, then, you know, the rule of law no longer works. So it is, again, unfortunate, very unfortunate, that we cannot simply have our own MOU yes. next to the MOU and be able to put there all the things that need to be done and are in nobody else's business but ours.
Okay. In the presentation, but also much more deeply in the book, you talk about Greece being the first to elect a populist government. And in actual fact, in the book, you go much further. In the book, you have the phrase, Greece chooses populists over realists anytime. Now, we can buy into the narrative of populism, and we can see that there are choices to be made. But deeper than that, what's the social explanation, what's the systemic explanation of why Greece would be more prone to populism than Portugal or one of the other bailout countries?
I think we feel better as Greeks after having seen some of the results in a number of other countries which made equally bad decisions as we did. So, but I think the explanation, I don't want to go into areas that I do not know well, and I do not want to start giving, you know, pop psychology or sociological explanations. But I do observe that in the other countries there has been an attempt to agree on the basics, which we could not do. Mm. Now, the fact that the Greek crisis was deeper and longer fed anger even more. But the kind of reaction to the bailouts was legitimized, unfortunately, by the conservative opposition back in 2010. If the conservative opposition, which was partly, not entirely, but partly responsible for the mess that was there in the first place, had taken a different tack, then maybe the beast of populism would not have flared up that much. But then if a mainstream party yes. buys into the populist narrative, then it's very easy for the whole population to do so.
Great. There's so many different things that George has covered, both domestically within Greece, but also for the Eurozone. So now an opportunity for you to ask questions. And I'm going to, if George is agreeable, if we could take, say, about three at a time or something like that. There are colleagues with microphones both upstairs and downstairs. Could we take the gentleman at the very back first, please? Could you just say who you are and then the question?
My name is Patrick Streeter. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My question is, what would have happened if the British and American governments had bailed out Greece and then gone ahead to remedy the economy by massive Keynesian public investments in Greek infrastructure.
Thank you. And then there's a gentleman in the middle here at the top, please.
In 2004,
could you say who you are, please?
Damianos. In 2004, your predecessor, but one, had the brilliant idea of doing an inventory, apography, in order to trash the performance of PASOK during the previous 18 years. I think you imitated, or you tell me if you disagree, you took your own revenge in 2009 by doing the same in reverse, and you said it was the deficit was not exactly inflated, but there are examples, and I can mention a few, that you took discretionary action to actually increase the deficit, leaving aside the fact that you did not take the fifth. You incriminated Greece as the minister, and you were on the, let's say, on the prosecution side, not the defense side. So do you agree that this was a revenge move that was a tremendous own goal? I'm not saying that this is Greece's macroeconomic indicators were diverging for the previous 30 years. The graphs you showed us take them from the 2009 onwards, but it was clear that Greece's economy was not sustainable. Increasing deficit with
we got the question. We got the question.
And the second thing.
No. We're fine. We've enjoyed your first question so much. We want to leave it alone. Could we take the gentleman here, please?
Constantine, you have, and I write and broadcast on Greece. Your initial title for the book was "How Greece Saved the Euro," and it. That was a remarkable title, and I agree with it. However, I would like to compare your first talk here 7 years ago, refreshing talk, very candid, and today's post-mortem. And there are two themes which occurred, one then and now. The first one is that the crisis could not have been foreseen to this extent, and you didn't know the depth of the debt. You mentioned it then, and you mentioned it again today. And the second one, which you mentioned then and today, is the popular resistance and the necessity to be re-elected, and how this prevents governments from taking full action. Now, I put it to you that in 2004, the new democracy government, one of the first things it said was that the debt was bigger than imagined, and it was criticized for spilling the beans. Therefore, you as advisor, I put it to you, would have known the depth of the crisis. And the second one about convincing the Greek people of the necessity to do this. A Greek newspaper or magazine had come here, which was to write certain positive aspects of the Greek government. But what it said outside the talk at the time, their comments were, if you have money in Greece, take it out. If you have property in Greece, sell it. In other words, not even they who are writing the public relations, I think the gentleman is here today, was convinced. But otherwise, thank you so much for being so candid and informative 7 years ago.
Thank you. I think those three questions are good enough to start with.
Yes, I think so too. I'm not sure I fully understood the first question. A British and US bailout as opposed to a Eurozone bailout. Certainly a bailout which gave Greece more money and more time to adjust and focused more on the structural issues would have been better. But of course you work with what you've got in the context that you are. Greece was and is a member of the Eurozone. The Eurozone had to take certain decisions. The UK was absent from that discussion, unlike the case of Ireland, by the way, where the UK actually participated in the bailout of Ireland. But in the Greek bailout, the UK took itself out. It could have, if it wanted, come in and perhaps even influence the debate. The US role, I have to say, throughout has been a very positive one. And one of the worries that I have with the new U.S. administration is that the previous U.S. administration, at critical moments, had the understanding, which I think was based on their own experience from the Lehman Brothers episode, of the fact that this is a systemic crisis, that you need systemic solutions. What we called in Greece and got often ridiculed for it, having a loaded gun on the table, was exactly what the U.S. had done with Lehman Brothers. You put $1 trillion on the table, and then you don't have to use it. In Europe, we didn't do it. By the time we specified how much money, it was came in increments, markets didn't buy it, so we had to go for the bailout. So, yes, a more Keynesian type of bailout, but not in terms of spending more, because I don't, you know, in 2008, Greece ran a 16% deficit, and its economy shrunk. So the massive expansion didn't really do very much to keep the economy. So it's not the question of having an expansion, it's a question of having more time to deal with the consolidation. Now let me come to the two questions, there's some similar points, the questions. Inventory 2004, inventory 2009, you incriminate Greece, was it not an ongoing? First of all, let me just say that and if you read the book, you'd see this very clearly. I'm not one of those that say that all was well in 2004. The problems with Greek statistics go back. The difference between 2004 and 2009 was A, an order of magnitude, and B, that between 2004 and 2009, Eurostat had closed a number of gray areas which every country, including Greece, had used in the early years of the euro. A classic one was the use of off-market swaps, which was legal back then, became illegal in 2007, and the Greek government in 2007, our predecessors, never bothered to declare the famous Goldman Sachs off-market swap. And then we had to come clean with it in 2010. Now, going, however, to the core of the question, did you incriminate Greece and spill the beans where you could have helped done otherwise? Well, let me put it to you this way. The Bank of Greece, at the end of September, meaning before the elections, had in its monthly bulletin a deficit of over 9%. Any economist with half a brain will tell you that that means that your deficit goes up by 1% every month. So how on earth could you end up with less than 12%? This was not the Greek government. This was the Bank of Greece, a central banker appointed by the previous government. So for me to then come out and say, don't listen to the Bank of Greece, when I have the figures in front of me, when on the second day in office I am given by our General Accounting Office the forgotten bulletins, because apart from the Bank of Greece, the Ministry of Finance is also supposed to bring out monthly budget execution bulletins. And magically, the monthly execution bulletins for June, July, and August were never seen the light of day. Were they not prepared? Yes, they were. They just happened to end up in the drawer of the minister, who decided that the national interest required to conceal those data. Well, you know, you can conceal up to a point, and after a certain point, you cannot conceal anymore. And I don't think that any responsible government should have continued the deceit. That was not our idea, to continue a deceit. In October every year, you make the budget for the year after that. What's your starting point? Fake accounts for 2009? Only to discover 3 months down the road that actually you had completely lied? We came up with the best possible estimate, 12.5. And even that turned out to be 3 points less than the final estimate when Eurostat had come in, looked through all the books, done a real audit on Greek accounts, and ended up with 15.7%. So we actually underestimated the real deficit. And it is also, and I think this is something that I give specific examples in the book, it is also not true that we in any way tried to inflate the deficit at the end of 2009. The opposite. We try to control to the extent that you can. However, anyone who knows national accounts will tell you that by the end of the year, there's very little room for maneuver. Why? Well, because 80% of the expenditures are expenditures for wages, pensions, and other social expenditures that need to be paid, except if you tell me that we should not have paid pensioners. The rest is discretionary expenditure. How much can we cut from that to clip the final year? So there are fundamental differences between 2004 and 2009, but I do say very clearly, 2004 was not all rosy. However, if in 2004 there was an underreporting of the deficit to the tune of half a percentage point, in 2009 you had an underreporting of the deficit to the tune of 9 percentage points, because the last official projection of the government 3 days before the elections was 6% of GDP. It ended up being 15.8. This is massive. In an economy of 220 billion, we somehow missed 31 billion somewhere. Where did it go?
Could I just follow that up then, George? Of course, you referred to the Bank of Greece. The then governor, Yorgos Pavlopoulos, says that he was telling each of the opposition parties in the week before the election that the deficit is 12% and could easily grow, etc. Isn't there then some kind of culpability with telling the people at the election there is money?
The famous phrase. This actually allows me to also come to the second question about the depth of the problem, because, you know, how much did one know beforehand? First of all, what actually Governor Pavlopoulos had then told us is that if it continues at this rate, it will reach double digits. So that's what he left us with. He did not leave us with 12 or more percent. And he has confirmed that in a number of... had we known the full extent of the disaster, we would have had a different narrative. However, and I regret that phrase was ever uttered, because it was taken out of context. If you read the phrase, it doesn't just read there is money. It says there is money if you do this for tax evasion, if you do this to control expenditure, if you do that. But the phrase was taken as it was and became the rallying flag of people who said, you deceived us. Okay. Actually, the election was not won on that. The election was won on a different slogan, which is either we change or we drown. Mm. That was the election slogan that won the election. Afterwards was when the there is money became a rallying flag for the opposition. Having said that, I wish we had never said it. And I wish we had been more circumspect before the elections. But the truth is that you never know the full extent, and that's the question, until you sit there. And it's not just the full extent of the damage, but also the inability to control, the inability to get your tax revenue up, the inability to get your tax administration to work, the inability to figure out how much hospitals were spending, where we figured this out years after it had been spent. Mm. Greece did not know, it's a sad fact, but it is true, did not know how to make an annual budget until 2010. It learned how to make an annual budget when the IMF team came down, and together we finally managed to do a proper budget in the way that other countries have done.
Okay, thanks. There are a number of people who want to ask questions. Could we take the lady over here, please?
My name is Sigrun Davidsdottir. I'm an Icelandic journalist, and Icelanders know a thing or two about crisis. Thanks for an extremely lucid and frank overview. You mentioned the lack of narrative, and I totally agree with you. That's extremely important for a country like Greece in its situation to find the narrative and also the ownership. And the lack of narrative, I think, you know, one symptom of that is the prosecution of the former head of Elstad, Andreas Georgiou. But I was just wondering, you know, after 7 years in this situation, or you know, 8 years maybe, what on earth does it take for Greece to kind of pull together and you know, get out of this doldrum. There is no end in sight as things are now.
Good, thanks. And then could we, thank you. Could you take the gentleman here, please?
Hi, thank you so much for the very informative presentation of the book I have read and I want to sign, signature. My name is Yanis Orfanos. I'm from Brostai Exterikou, from Forward Greece. I think you did, you spoke to some of the members a few weeks ago in Athens. My question would be simple. You mentioned 4 prime ministers, 9 finance ministers. I want your opinion from 3 and 2 plus 1, George Papandreou, Adonis Samaras, Tsipras, Varoufakis, Mr. Venizelos, and the last one, Mr. Mitsotakis. I want your views.
I think the question implied that there had to be a number one in that list. There had to be some rank order of preference that can't all be relegated. Can we take the gentleman in the middle, please? Yeah, sorry, Anglid, here. Yeah, if you could just, thank you.
Hi, I'm David Wood. My question is about the future. You've talked here twice. In some ways, not much has changed. Other ways, the understanding is deeper. What's the chance that if you come back here and talk in 5 or 7 years' time, there would still be a euro crisis, or there'll still be a euro indeed? And what's the chance that you would still be discussing yet another bailout for Greece in that stage? What's the scenarios that you see over that timescale?
Okay. And can we take the lady here? And then this has got to be the final question, I'm afraid.
Hi, my name is Kira. I'm a PhD student at the European Institute. And I wanted to ask you if the Greek government had any choice over the IMF's involvement in the first bailout, and if in hindsight you believe that the IMF's involvement has played a positive role helping Greece to come out of the crisis somehow. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me take, I'll take them in sequence. The question posed by Sigrun, is there an end in sight? Look, what will it take? What it will take is for some, to use a very often used phrase, some light in the tunnel. Because when you are deep in recession and you see no future, then how can you be an optimist and how can you sort of make the leap of faith to change your behavior and be, you know, you cannot. Or vote more responsibly. You vote with anger, with disappointment, with disillusion. So, you know, you need to have some hope. And this is one of the problems that I see at the moment, which is that this we continue to have this drip feed approach. And it's partly because of the lack of trust between Greece and the institutions and between Greece and particular countries. The idea that, you know, these guys will go off the rails anyway, so we might as well, we can't let them die, but so we'll keep drip feeding them, but we won't give them too much because then, you know, we'll lose the leverage over them. And that's what's driving the lack of quick resolution of the issue of debt relief. That's what's driving the having very high primary surpluses. And if that does not change, it will be much harder to see the end in sight. I'm going to take the fifth on the people. I will just say the following. I will give you one sort of one word, and it will be a expunged kind of version. I think George Papandreou took some very tough decisions in a difficult time, and he bought the country time, but I also think that he made mistakes in managing the crisis. But on the big stuff, he did the right thing. I very much regret Andonis Samaras's first period as an anti-bailout politician. I was very happy to see him change his tune, and I think that he himself regrets his reverting to the populist stance at the end of his tenure. Alexis Tsipras has discovered how Europe works because he did not know. This is not, it's a statement of fact. It is not a criticism. And what I can say that is positive is that after taking the country to the brink, he looked down and didn't take the additional step. I am grateful for that, because he could have. So that's one positive thing which I can say. I'm skipping finance ministers because it's too close to home. In Kyriakos Mitsotakis, you have somebody who is a reformer. It's one of the supreme ironies that he comes from a very old family which carries baggage, but is the hope for reform in the country. I do worry about his party and whether he can indeed be the reformer that he claims to be. We will see that. Where will we be in 5 years? Well, I could easily dismiss this question and saying, well, we're certainly not going to be here. But if you asked me this question in 2010, of course, you would get the same answer, and here we are. I do believe that the euro will survive. I think that the people who, you know, like Oscar Wilde, think my death has been greatly exaggerated. I think people miss the political imperative of keeping the euro together. I think that we're going to be seeing a circling of the wagons effect. When your very existence is threatened by the combination of Brexit and a hostile US, you rally. So except if we have some disasters in 2017, one of the elections, and France is the obvious one, if the elections go all right, then at the end of the year, I think you will see, and I do hope that this is not just wishful thinking, you will see a second wind in the project. And it's not going to be just over EMU. It could be over common defense, security policy, and completing the EMU, with the banking union being the easy part, I think, the low-hanging fruit. Finally, the question about any choice for the IMF. The IMF, I think, has now been well established, was the personal decision of Angela Merkel against the advice of her Minister of Finance and against the wishes of the ECB and everyone else in the Eurogroup. She said, no money except if the IMF is in. Has the IMF been a positive or negative element? Actually, it's been a positive contributor to the whole, to the Troika. And I know that, again, this is not the standard opinion in Greece. However, the IMF had a much more reasonable, technocratic, fiscal path for the country. The IMF, in the initial negotiation, bought us an additional year. We went from 3 years in the Stability and Growth Program, which the Commission had stamped with its approval, to 4 years in the beginning of negotiation, to 5 years between 2010, 11, 12, 13, and 14 to do the adjustment. The fifth year was given by the IMF because the IMF could see a little bit more clearly the difficulty of the economy. The European side was working much more on political expediency. And time and over again, the IMF was more lucid on a number of things. Debt restructuring was one. The IMF opened that discussion before anyone else in. And the IMF is right now when it asks for additional debt relief and lower primary surpluses. And it is, I think, a testament of the warped political system that we have, that instead of saying the IMF is right, we actually want to kick the IMF out of the program. And I see many people, even ex-finance ministers, write about how terrible it is. I mean, as a European, I'd like a European program, but like a European program on sound basis. And at the moment, I don't really see that. I have no doubt that if the IMF leaves, the ESM can run a program. But I do value the experience of the IMF. I know it has certain set ideas on things, and we disagreed on when it went to extremes in issues such as labor market reform, for example. But on the fiscal path and on the debt relief, I think they were more right than wrong.
Okay, I know some of you have already bought the book, and there is the opportunity of buying the book outside the theatre. We persuaded George to come back and sign copies.
You have to twist my arm on this one.
to sign the copies here on stage afterwards, if you would like to do so. What might happen in 5 years' time if we invite George back then? It may, of course, be an ideal opportunity for the LSE to have another production of the Threepenny Opera, I think. And let me say that I'll book myself in, and I'm I'm very good at singing in the shower, and I now see my opportunity here in the All Theatre, but only if George joins me on this occasion. However, before we look forward to that memorable event, can you please join me in thanking George Papakonstantinou? Thank you very much, indeed.
How do you switch it on?
For those of you that have books, if you'd like to make your way outside, and you're going to be brought back in from the door over there. So if you go outside and turn left.
Περιμένω να μαζευτούμε και έρχομαστε στη ζωή εκεί. Έγινε.
Are you here for the book signing or are you
Όχι, όχι.
Ωραία. Αν σας είναι εύκολο.
Θες να πάρεις ζητά. Τι δικό σου είναι αυτό.
Yes, exactly.
Your people want you.
Brothers.
Just outside here, if you don't mind waiting.
Shall we bring people in? I mean, let's not.
I just want to say goodbye. And my friend is down there for talking to Jaco.
I should say hello.
Yeah, go ahead and sell your books.
This is not going to be. It's not going to take long. Wait, 10
okay, okay, okay.
Ne, proszę, kurwa, ne.
I told her you were going to do this. She said, "Get me a cup, get him to get him to sign it." I said, "Okay."
Contingent here.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
How are you? Yes, come back.
Yes. Talking about you, we enjoyed very much. I don't know, we met you recently, right?
In Maastricht.
Because of the celebrations. I wonder, was the book already out when you met?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so it probably has one.
I sent it to you.
Ah, okay. If not, I would buy one too. I bring him a very good friend.
Who did I make that?
Francisco. I'm here at the Lycée de Bordeaux.
In the West Department?
At the European University. See you later, I think we have 2 years.
Ah, great.
Okay, I hope to catch up with you soon. Bye.
So I wasn't
He's not Greek, he's with us 100%.
Εγώ ξέρω ότι. Ποιο. 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 Ποι Λοιπόν, δυστυχώς δεν θα είμαι στο dinner, οπότε την επόμενη φορά. Θα μείνεις μέρες.
Θα ξανάρθει.
Θα έρθεις αύριο.
Θα ξανάρθει.
Θα το
δούμε.
Μαρίνα. Καλά, καλά. Έλεγα εδώ ότι το αγαπημένο μου βιβλίο της οικογένειας είναι της γυναίκας, συγγνώμη. Γιατί μας έχει φανεί πάρα πολύ χρήσιμο.
Ποιο είναι το βιβλίο της γυναίκας.
Η γυναίκα σου είναι εδώ.
Για τα καλύτερα ξενοδοχεία της Ελλάδας και είναι πολύ πιο καλύτερα. Α, τα καλύτερα. Ναι, σωστά.
Ευχαριστώ.
You haven't got any jackets or coats in the green room?
It's okay, we've arranged someone's going to take it
take
down.
Take that, okay, that's right.
Κρασοπόπερα και εσείς, ε. Oh, yeah. The banner case is somewhere at the back.
I'm just deleting.
Can we trade numbers? Yeah.
I think we're good, no?